Anyway, today's Dante Day, right? So let's do a little Dante. And for Thursday, I put, for today we're supposed to do the first five cantos, they're called, of the Inferno. And for Thursday, I put down a bunch of cantos from the Purgatory. But what I'd like to do instead, and my attempt to generate something, what I want you to do for Thursday is pick one canto yourself, all right? And read it and summarize it, and I'll try and put something on the exam, but bring it into class so that you can talk about what goes on in that canto. There's 33 cantos in the Inferno, there's 33 in the Purgatory, they're not all in the book. And you can go to page 1457, where we're going to start right now. 1457. And you see there's a map here of hell. There's a picture of it. Now, Dante didn't leave us a picture, but lots of artists like to try and draw. And you can see all the circles in hell. And if you're particularly interested in one sin or another, you can try and locate it in there. You can see down the right side the lustful, which we'll get to today, then the gluttonous, the prodigal, the wrathful, heretics, the violent, and then all kinds of... the eighth circle has many subsections because that's the circle of fraud. Now Dante divides the Inferno into two major categories of sin. The violent ones that use force, in other words, if I beat you up or kill you or murder you or steal from you, and those that are sins of fraud, deception. And for Dante, violence isn't the big issue. It's deception. It's fraud. So the very bottom of hell is for traitors. Okay. Well, you can pick one of those. You can pick one in Inferno. I'll let you poke around without saying too much about it. So let's talk a little bit about Dante. Okay. This is one of the big moments in any world literature course, because this is a world class poet. T.S. Eliot said that Shakespeare and Dante divide the world between them. And it's probably pretty close. Although I got to say, I think Dante is a nuttier poet than Shakespeare. Shakespeare we know much less about. We don't know anything about Shakespeare. We have his plays, we have his Iago, we have Hamlet. We know nothing about Shakespeare. Dante's personality forces itself on us. It's a very personal poet, right? And he shapes his life into poetry. He's full of passions. He's full of hate. When he does the hell, it's full of his people he doesn't like. Okay? So you don't want to mess around with Dante, which includes a lot of popes, right? The date of the story is 1300. Right, so we just want to pause over that for a second. What you were watching here, that clip from Parzival by Chrétien de Troyes, remember that's 1170. 1170. The Western languages are just developing. Right? French is the language of Chrétien de Troyes, and the French is the dominant language. Okay. Italian doesn't really develop till later, but they're both Romance languages. So if you're living in 1170 and you realize you're in France and you're speaking French, and somebody's in Italy and speaking Italian, you're using a lot of words that are the same, because both languages came from Latin. And then the period between, say, 500, when we left St. Augustine, and 1170, say 700 years, the world fell apart. Right. This is what we used to call the Dark Ages. Violence, there was no central authority, and people, the communications broke down. and the languages just developed locally because there wasn't that much interaction. So the Romance, the big Romance languages are French and Italian and Spanish. You know, they're all related. I can't think of a word right now that pops into mind, but you can think of one. Okay. Romanian was another. What are the others? Not German. That's the point. German's separate. German is German. Because the Germans were not inside the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire went up to the Rhine River and not across it. Okay? And the English were, as we looked before, were speaking a Germanic language, Anglo-Saxon, which Beowulf was written in. So the now, how did you get out of the Dark Ages? All right? You know, what, well, it wasn't, there were a number of things. But one of the developments was commerce. And Dante comes from a town called Florence, Italy. Have you ever heard of Florence? It's the center of the art world in the Italian Renaissance. And even today, a fairly beautiful city, but they do a reasonable job keeping it together. It was one of the wealthier towns in the Middle Ages, and the money was made through artisans, craftsmen, local craftsmen. Even today, your finest leather goods in the world come from little boutiques in Florence. You can go there and spend a fortune. Now, the fashion industry is essentially in Milan, but because that's the bigger city, but it's not that far. But in Florence for jewelry, for fine paper, and cloth. It was the center of the weaving world. That was, remember we saw Penelope weaving, I think I mentioned to you that, I mean, cloth was everything. Cloth was money. There wasn't a lot else. So you can trade horses, and people in Toledo made swords, but, you know, wool work, making clothes was the big thing. And wool would come from lots of places like England, but it would come in a raw form, and to really know how to work it, to dye it, to make different kinds of fabrics, right? Velours and corduroys and, you know, stuff like that, which we don't even, satins, we don't even think about today, but they were huge. When the only thing you had, really, was your clothes to distinguish you. So if you're wealthy today, what do you get? You get a house full of, I was watching this old house, full of a million miles of computer cable that you don't need, right? You get a big car. But even that's a bummer because you can buy a Bugatti, but it's not that much better than a Kia, right? So right? They've got the auto industry right out there on the edge. But you know, everybody wants to spin to be better than the neighbors, and clothing was the way you could do it. You start weaving little threads of gold in there, gets expensive. Florence is the center of that industry, and people made fortunes, right? Absolute fortunes. One of these little towns, the money came in and it stayed for a while and went out. You get that kind of things in the history of the world, the local places that get really rich. Silicon Valley today, Nantucket, Massachusetts was once the wealthiest city in the world in the 1850s. Wealthiest per capita income because of the whale oil money. Lasted for 20 years. Right, and so you get that. And Florence had its big moment. Well, with lots of people competing, they made so much money, people never know quite what to do with their money. So they do two things. They realize people die, and they start endowing churches. And Florence is in Italy, and it built huge cathedrals. But even beyond that, it started endowing the art that went in them. And after Dante's time, things really accelerated, and you had people like Michelangelo working there. But the idea was they had enough money to get the world's best artists working for them. And the other thing you do when you have lots of money is fight with your neighbors, because you got nothing better to do. There's nothing like greed to really stir things up. And that's pretty much Dante's world, right? All this money, people want control of it. And he lived in a time, that the two big powers in Italy, I mean, you have to have some source of authority in any government, right? We have the United States Constitution, and we have the local Lafayette police. You need somebody people tend to respect, right? So Italy never quite got a central source of authority that everybody could agree on, because there was two competing powers, right? There was the Pope down in Rome, and he thought he should control everything, right? But then there were these, the what they call the Holy Roman Emperors, these powerful German magnates, okay, who would get together and elect a guy, okay? And they thought, and they both thought they had biblical precedent, because, you know, that it's render unto Caesar what Caesar's, render unto God what's God's, right? Well, if you're on the emperor's side, you say, well, that's, we're the local Caesar now, okay? So Dante's time, the church and the empire were competing over Italy. Who gave things away? And there's a lot to give away, because all your local money is going into churches and monasteries and very, very developed religious establishments, okay? And as the money came in, these religious establishments get richer and richer. What do I mean by that? Well, if you're a monk, and we'll see this in Chaucer's Canterbury Tale, you may have like a 10,000-acre spread out there in Williamsport, okay, that some guy died, you know, Rossay died and left it to you because he didn't want to give it to Purdue. And you got 500 monks there, and they might even have a little place for the women, too. So you got 10,000 acres. Now, these are monks, and they're living a celibate religious life, right? So they're not producing kids in the monastery. So when they die, who gets it, right? Well, somebody gets the right to appoint the next head abbot, and that's pretty good. That's like running the Harvard endowment, right? I don't know if you follow that, but you got $30 billion, and who gets to make the decisions how to invest that? Well, there's a bunch of guys doing it. You know what they make? They make like $30 million a year, right? Just because they have some, this is the way investment bank works, because they have so much money there. So everybody wants to be head of the endowment. It doesn't make you any smarter. You're probably just Joe, I mean, it's just a guy, or team of thieves, or whatever. And they'll have the same thing now that Purdue's got a $1 billion investment. You can bet a hot job in this town, be head of it, right? Oh, it's $1 billion. I guess I should get paid a lot for making the same dumb decisions I make at home. Well, I'm cynical. I'm the guy. They will get paid a lot. That's all there is to it, right? But there's money at stake, right? And then people get appointed. So there's a lot of pressure. And there's a lot of competition. And Dante lived in this competitive world, and things really, in his lifetime, things really were just falling apart. So his story is really of a world that was not working anymore. And he himself was in the middle of these political turmoils. And in 1300, he lived in Florence. These cities, Italy had these city-states, Rome, Florence, Venice. Now, Venice had its lagoons, but the other ones had to have walls. You got inside the walls. And the walls lasted until essentially 1850 in all these cities. And by that time, the cannons were good enough. Even in Napoleon's era, okay, the siege of Acre in Jerusalem, the cannonballs would bounce off the walls. The walls were that strong, and the cannon just weren't that powerful. But by 1850, they could get through anything. So walls didn't mean anything anymore, right? Big breakthrough in technology just in time for the Civil War, okay? Anyway, so Dante's in this walled city of Florence, and there's all kinds of factionalism, and his end loses, okay? And they exile him and take his property. And he goes wandering around Italy, chewing his lip and really angry and writing the Divine Comedy, right? But that's just one side of him. He obviously is a major guy. So let me just go through. But he did it in unbelievable poetry, which let's hop to. Let's start at 1456. What you need to know here is at the bottom, he's born in Florence in the spring of 1265. That means if he's writing, if the poem is set in the year 1300, which is was a jubilee year when people would travel to Rome, he's 35 years old, according to the story. All right. On page 1458, you just see in the first paragraph, they'll talk more about these political conflicts I'm talking about. The political conflicts. Politics doesn't always work out, you know. It's worth finding out. And they talk about the factions. And there were the two big ones were the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. The Guelphs were the side of the Pope. Those are the two short words, Guelph, Pope. The Ghibellines are the side of the Emperor. But you don't really need to know that stuff too much. You just need to know that there was politics in the background of this thing. And then further down the page, the last paragraph, he says, the poem's organized according to an ethical pattern. So Dante's sort of wondering why, if everything's falling apart. He doesn't think, he thinks politically, but he can't get too far. He'd like to have a nice Roman emperor come in and take over. Right? Never happens. So he thinks there must be something wrong with us as people. If we can just fix our nature, our behavior, our ethics, if we could stop sinning, the world would get better. Right? So really this poem is an exposure of sin. Now, sin in the Middle Ages was a well-discussed topic, right? And behind a lot of Dante's, this notion of the seven deadly sins, okay? Pride, envy, wrath, and avarice are the big ones. The Middle Ages loved sevens, okay? Pride was the sin of Satan, who was the number two angel to God, wanted to be God. Therefore, lived in, you know, he's so proud, so he fell. And pride is the root of all our sins. Now, pride in English isn't quite as powerful as it is in Latin or Italian. We can say, I'm proud of my work, and that's okay, right? This is more superbia. I got to be number one. Anything less than number one, you know, I don't sleep at night. This would be Sumner Redstone School of Life. The guy who runs Viacom, 84 years old, right? And just sued YouTube for $1 billion, 84, got divorced last year after 50. These guys never stop. Thinks, you know, can't stand not being number one. Can't stand it, all right? So pride is number one, envy is number two, wrath, that's just anger, and avarice, greed, okay? And then there's the carnal, so these are spiritual sins. There's carnal sins, gluttony, sloth, and lechery. These are fancy words for eating too much, sleeping too much, and I'll let you figure that one out. Okay. Dating too much, how's that? Hanging out too much. All right. Those are the seven sins. So let's take a look at this poem and get through some of it. Let's jump to 1465. I don't know if you've seen. This is always it was certainly an eye-opener for me. It's an eye-opener for a lot of people. Maybe it's an eye-closer. We'll find out. And I'm not, this translation's reasonable. This is by Mark Musa, who is a very nasty professor at Indiana University. So I say, the hell with this. It should not be in a Purdue book. He's a real jerk. I know him. He's retired. We have a much better translation by my friend Alan Mandelbaum, who is on the videotape of Dante. So I thought I'd read the Mandelbaum while you follow along on the Musa translation, because I haven't been doing much translation. You'll find them pretty close. Are you with me? So you're looking at midway along the journey of our life. I woke to find myself in a dark wood, where I had wandered off from the straight path. And Mandelbaum says, when I had journeyed half of our life's way, I found myself within a shadowed forest, where I had lost the path that does not stray. When I had journeyed half of our life's way, midway along the journey of our life. So what does that mean? Right? He's 35, so how long does he expect to live? 70. Okay, so you've seen this. Yeah, that seems about right. I woke, he says in the second line, but in the first line he says, our life. Why our? Our life? Yeah, yeah. So, in other words, he's not, even though he's going to talk about himself, and we know Dante likes to talk about himself, that was the first point, he is telling you in the first line, it ain't about me. It's about you. It's us. It's our life. This is a very deliberate use of the pronoun. Nostra vita. Okay. I think I'm going to delay the... somebody asked me if I'm going to give you clues on the exam next week, and when I write it, what I did last time, I wrote the exam, it was a little hard, so I figured I'd send you those clues. But I'll write it this weekend and decide. Remember, there's no class next Tuesday, day before the exam. Right? I'll try and get you stuff, because I really want you to read the stuff, even if I have to give you a guide for rereading, all right? Just because something's not on my guide, don't forget, doesn't mean it's not on the exam, right? You call it the syllabus. When they forget something or something like that. Anyway, this is the journey of his life. And we're in a motif. It's fascinating that so he's going to structure this story as a journey. Now, if we go back to Homer, we had the model of the Iliad and the model of the Odyssey. Are we in the Odyssey model here or the Iliad model? The Iliad was the wrath of Achilles, sit out the fight and then come back in. The model of the Odyssey is get from Calypso back home. It's that journey. Okay? So we're really in an Odyssey moment. Now, Dante famously did not know Homer because there were no manuscripts of the Odyssey available in 1300 in Italy. They came in 50 years later, all right, from Istanbul. But Dante knew enough about the Odyssey from other references, shows up in classical, that Odysseus, or in the Latin, Ulysses, is in his mind. And in the Inferno, Canto 26, he actually meets Ulysses in hell. Okay, in a wild scene. I don't want all of you to jump and make that the one you pick for Thursday, but you might read it anyway. I didn't assign it, but I probably should have. So there's Ulysses down there talking about what he did after he got home. He instantly grew tired of Penelope and got his guys together and set sail for the ends of the earth. Okay, and where they sank. Because he's got false goals. So the big picture here is getting, the Odyssey getting home, right? But the Christian understanding was always, well, there's something wrong about the home. The home must be more. It's like it's getting on your exam. It's sort of getting back to God, is how it's, written. And that's the journey Dante's taking. He needs to get back to God. And at the end of the Paradiso, in Canto 100, he sees God. It's a pretty wild who comes in the form of a giant celestial rose with ranks of angels singing hallelujah and stuff like that. It's pretty crazy. But it's still a journey, right? And it's a journey of education, right? So it fits this very medieval pattern that would read the Odyssey as a journey of education. I haven't gone through it that way, but you can see it. Which we've seen just saw in the Percival story. We have an uneducated young man going through life, making mistakes, and Chretien's just so far out there, the lessons aren't obvious. And later in the story, he'll see the Grail and not understand it. And Chretien won't even bother to explain what the Grail is. He might not have even cared. But everybody else wanted to know what it was, so the Grail became this big symbol. Okay? The thing you have to know, right? Well, it's a symbol two ways. It's part of an educational experience, which is pictured as a journey, I don't know if you picture your time, your 4 years at Purdue as a journey, or is it just one way station in hell? And the other thing is to sort of is to get some kind of a divine knowledge. But so anyway, we're on the first line. So midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood. In Italian, a selva oscura. That's the woods. That's like obscure. Mandeba has a shadowed forest. What does it mean to wake up in the shadows? What? What does it mean to wake up? What? Right. He's like, suddenly he realized, I'm 35 years old, I ain't married. No, he was married. Whatever. You know, something happened at the age of 35 that woke him up. All right. So we know it's some kind of awakening. It's not a literal thing. This is that metaphoric language. And Dante is the supreme master of the metaphoric language. He's so good, the scholars have been arguing for hundreds of years over what he meant by a lot of these things. But we get the general idea. He wakes up. He's still in the shadows. Right? So it seems like he knows something's wrong, but he hadn't figured out what it is. He's in the dark. And what the point of this first canto will be to find the sunlight. And he sees the sun up there. And in one of his writings, Dante, you know, he's pretty open sometimes, says nothing better than the sun as an image of God. But he doesn't call it an image of God in the poem. He just says he sees the sun. And we can take it as we want. And he has to get up a mountain to get to it. Right? Well, let's just continue these metaphors. So he wakes up, he's in a dark wood, which seems to mean he still hasn't found his way. And he's there because he had wandered off from the straight path. Now, what's the image of the straight path? See, it's like everybody's dying to write footnotes to Dante. And the history of Dante is people writing these footnotes, starting with his own two sons. Okay, and then Boccaccio. And I actually had my entire spring break ruined because I'm editing a collection of essays on the purgatory, and they just came on, all the page proofs came back and had to be corrected. I get a week. This is 26 years in the making. They give me a week to get these things back. That's crazy. And I got 33 contributors, all of them angry. Anyway, people write footnotes to these things. They wonder, the straight path would be the moral way, wouldn't it? If you wander off the straight path, you've done something wrong. The great mystery in Dante studies is, what did he do that was so bad? And we really don't know, all right? But he talks about it a lot, not just in the comedy, but in his other works. He's got a, which I'll talk about in a minute. Let's just read a little more. How hard it is to tell what it was like. This wood of wilderness, how hard it is to tell what it was like. This is a very different moment in the history of literature. This is first person. Dante telling you, and the myth here, all of this happened to him. He woke up. He was in a dark wood. Now he's sitting down and writing it up and trying to explain to you what it was like. He's got to use, and the only thing he's got is language. No videotapes, right? No slideshows, just words. And nobody puts more pressure on sheer words than Dante. Now this is, you know, all this is in the past, right? Now that we got YouTube, right? But this is what Dante's all about. He's got a problem of poetics. How's he going to get it across to you? And he made a couple of decisions. In other words, he's come back from Plato's cave. You know, he's like one of the guys in Plato's cave. He's seen the truth, and he's got to get it across to those people who are only looking at shadows, which is us. Right? So he's trying to get across what it was like to go through hell, purgatory, and up through the levels of the planets until out beyond the stars you see God. And now he's come back, and he's going to tell us all about it. And he wants us to believe it. This is a very serious guy. How hard it is to tell what it was like. This wood of, right now the immediate problem is just telling about this wood of wilderness, savage and stubborn, that savage forest, dense and difficult. The thought of it brings back all my old fears. That's a kind of easy line to skip in this translation. Here it is. Which even in recall renews my fear. I mean, this happened, you know, it's already happened, but like he's got the post-traumatic stress syndrome or whatever they call it. Right? He's still shaking over it. It was bad, that savage shadowed forest, whatever it was. A bitter place. Death could scarce be bitterer. This is a long night, right? A bad night. We all do bad stuff. We had this bad night. But if I would show the good that came of it, I must talk about things other than the good. I don't know. I give that an F. That's a translation. I'll also tell, but to retell the good discovered there, I'll also tell the other things I saw. And just for laughs, I don't know if they're laughing or not. Here, this is the Dorothy Sayers translation. She was a famous novelist this century. I'll just read the first. Midway, this way of life we're bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark wood where the right road was wholly lost and gone. Ay me, how hard to speak of it, that rude and rough and stubborn forest. The mere breath of memory stirs the old fear in the blood. It is so bitter, it goes nigh to death. Yet there I gained such good, that to convey the tale, I'll write what else I found therewith. How I got into it, I cannot say. How I entered there, I cannot truly say. I had become so sleepy at the moment when I first strayed, leaving the path of truth. In case you wondered what that path was. Was he really on a path? Was he really in a dark wood? It doesn't seem like it. It seems like he's saying, look, I had this experience, you know, you guys in the cave here. And it was like being in a shadowed forest, if I can help you. Now, you guys never been in a shadowed forest, right, where you're really lost, right? I mean, and it's really dark. Have you ever, like, really been in the dark? I know my daughter's never even been outdoors. Okay. she said, the car, the house, that's, you know, who needs the outdoors? Anyway, that's the idea here. Well, let me just read a bit. How I entered there, I cannot truly say. I had become so sleepy at the moment when I first strayed. There's that third line. Leaving the path of truth. But when I found myself at the foot of a hill, at the edge of the wood's beginning, down in the valley, where I first felt my heart plunged deep in fear, I raised my head and saw the hilltop shawled in morning rays of light sent from the planet that leads men straight ahead on every road. Now, what's the planet that leads men straight ahead on every road? Yeah, that's the sun. The sun's a planet, don't forget, because the earth is... You got to remember, the world is not flat for Dante. I just saw a commercial, they're saying, you know, people used to think the world was flat in the Middle Ages. No one thought the world was flat. Right? Everybody knew it was round. It's always round. The only people who think it's flat are some sect in Kentucky in the 1890s. Okay, because if you think about it, it's round. You can see the ships going over the horizon. You can see the curve of the earth on the moon. Okay, you know, people always thought it was round. The flat earth thing is nonsense. But they believed it stood still and that the other planets circulated around it. And it's not until Copernicus in the Renaissance in about 1570 that we get the notion that the Earth goes around the sun. You know, and technically, I suppose from the big picture, it's hard to tell which one's actually moving. You know? So, anyway, it's the sun that leads men on a straight path. You notice the way he speaks indirectly, he speaks poetically. He almost challenging you to figure out the meaning of these things. And so far in this course, the meaning of prophetic words has been pretty obvious. You know, seven fat cows and seven lean cows, you kind of get the message. But Dante, it's both obvious and not obvious, all right? We get the notion of the journey. Only then did terror start subsiding in my heart's lake. You got a footnote on this, which absolutely ruins the poetry by trying to explain the heart's lake. I think it's a brilliant image, okay? You know, the lake of your heart, that deep, dark place, you know, that's where fear really sits, right? Well, he wants to get to the sun and get on the right path, and he starts to climb a mountain, this hill, okay? And he's stopped on page 1466 by three beasts that no one can figure out exactly what they mean. But whatever keeps you from going up the mountain, think Martin Luther King, I'm going up the mountain, you know, we know what that means. It ain't a mountain he's climbing, right? It's overcoming a social problem, right? It's a figure of speech. There are three beasts. They are a leopard at line 33. You see the leopard? There are a lion at line 45 and a she-wolf at line 49. Three beasts. You don't even need to know the footnotes. All you need to know for me is it's three beasts. They mean something. Something keeps him from getting up there. And when he's stuck at the bottom, a figure comes out of the forest towards him. And this is the last line on 1466. While I was rushing to that, down to that low place, pushed, you know, running away from these three beasts out of fear, and it may just be fear of ascending any mountain, fear of the sun itself. Right? My eyes made out a figure coming toward me of one grown faint, perhaps from too much silence. And when I saw him standing in this wasteland, have pity on my soul, I cried to him, whichever you are, shade or living man. In other words, help! No longer living man, says this figure. The once I was, he said, and my parents were from Lombardy. Both of them Mantuans by birth. I was born under Augustus. This figure at the bottom of the mountain is Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, which you read the Dido episode in. And he says in line 72, I was a poet and sang of that just man, son of Anchises, who sailed off from Troy after the burning of proud Ilium. Ilium being another name for Troy. Okay, Dante says, you're Virgil? Holy mackerel, I read you all the time. As a matter of fact, I read you so much that I've developed my own poetic style by studying the Aeneid till I have it memorized. He says in line 87, and you alone, let's start at 85, you are my teacher, the first of all my authors, and you alone the one from whom I took the noble style that was to bring me honor. Okay? Now this is a very complicated line, but clearly he's reading Virgil, he knows who he is. So he hallucinates Virgil. Now what does this mean? Well, I'm running out of time, so let's get right to the chase here. First of all, Virgil wrote in Latin. This is the kind of thing that you have to know on the exam, remember? Just know that it's in Latin. Or Dante's writing in Italian, okay? But Italian is, you know, close enough to Latin that there's some similarity. So Dante learns how to... When Dante, in the second line, said, how am I going to write this up for you people in the cave? You know, what's my poetic? One of his answers was this incredible decision to write the Divine Comedy not in Latin, which was the language of education, and people wrote in Latin right up to 1800, okay, but to write in Italian, okay, a local vernacular language. Nel mezzo di cammin di nostra vita, right? It's Italian, it's like French. That so only Italians are really going to understand it. And it was a monumental decision. You know, but he could see which way the linguistic winds were going, okay? And he just went with Italian. Right? And he claims that he got good at Italian by reading Virgil's Latin. So that's the stylistic side. The main thing, though, is he needs a guide to get him through hell. 33 cantos of hell. What does it mean? And Virgil will be his guide. What does that mean? It means that the experience of reading the Aeneid for him was equivalent to understanding all the sins of hell. You see it? To meet Virgil and have him as your guide is as if to say, you know, it's like reading the Aeneid. Now, we didn't go through the 12 books of the Aeneid, but clearly Dante read it with bugged out open eyes. Okay? I mean, it was just mind-blowing to him, everything that went on there. The founding of Rome. Okay? I'll save for a minute. Let's go in order. Okay? Anyway, Virgil says in line 102, you've got to come with me. We have to take this other path. You'll never get straight up that mountain. You can't climb the mountain until the greyhound comes. Line 101, until the greyhound comes. Nobody knows what that means. Okay? It sounds like it means Italy's a mess. We got lions and tigers and bears. But maybe the Holy Roman Emperor will come and solve our problems. But we can't be sure of that. Something, which Dante calls a greyhound, will chase the wild animals away. But until that moment of political pacification, you're going to have to go the ethical route. We're going to have to learn about sins because it's probably you that are the problem. Okay? And and Virgil says, I can take you just so far. Because Virgil himself is a pagan. Line 127. Okay. I can't get into the city of God, says Virgil, because he died in 19 BC before Jesus, right? So he couldn't be a Christian. So you know, this was a very hard thing for early Christian thinkers, but they basically decided, well, that's too bad. If you were born before Christ, you go to limbo at best. You can't go to heaven. And this runs all the way through it. And it's very heartbreaking because Virgil, our favorite poet, who Dante read all the time, is consigned to limbo. But there's the answer. Anyway, let's go to Canto 2 quickly. The day was fading and the darkening air was releasing all the creatures on our earth from their daily task. And I, one man alone, io sol uno, I, io, sol, solo, uno, one. Io so uno. Now Mandelbaum says this is the first triple repetition of the first person pronoun, and that's what's on the tape if you watch the first line's tape, which you'll watch eventually. It's the I, you know, the interior person, the struggle within that's the subject here that makes this so different. And this triple repetition here, I, one man, alone, is really a very nothing like it. Before Dante. This is not Beowulf, this is not Gilgamesh. Right? This is the first person guy. Line 8 there. O memory, O muses, O high genius, help me now. O memory that wrote down what I saw. The poem recalls the experience. It's a first person account. Using now this Italian language, okay, like a cave, all right? And Virgil says, gee, you wrote all about the Aeneid, and you know why it's important? Because Aeneas was founding Rome. This is line 21. Father of glorious Rome and her empire. And, well, that's who cares about that, but don't you see? That's where the popes are now. Out of the Roman Empire came the church, which Dante is completely devoted to, the Catholic Church in Rome, where the successors, line 24, the successors of St. Peter sit. Peter being the first pope. Right? Now, Dante's time, the papacy was falling apart. He had all these corrupt guys, and the deepest circles in hell go to the popes on Dante's time who were squabbling with each other. And it was so bad that in 1302, the papacy actually moved from Italy to Avignon, France. This just blew everybody's mind, okay? And it stayed there for 70 years, right? So, oh, hell was breaking loose, okay, as far as Dante was concerned. But, you know, he had the idea of the church there. Well, Virgil says to him at line 45, you know, the problem with you, Dante, I'm going to take you through hell, but you're a coward. You don't even want to go. Get it together. Dante's going, hey, I don't want to go down there. Right? And Virgil has to pump him up, and he says, and the reason he says that Dante's going to even get this opportunity to fix himself up ethically by taking this tour, this educational tour, okay, of hell, purgatory, and paradise, is because a lady summoned Virgil, line 53. A lady summoned me. This is Beatrice. Okay? Beatrice, a figure in Dante's life, saw him stuck at the bottom of the mountain, conferred with the other girls up in heaven. All right, I don't have time to go through this canto two in too detail, all right? And sent Virgil to help him. And you get all these women who are helping Dante. You got Beatrice. You got this woman named Lucia at line 97, whose name means light, lux. You got the Virgin Mary. And you have Rachel at line 103. Read it through. It's so brilliant that it's women who saved Dante. This is so medieval, okay? You know, putting the woman on the pedestal is the complete medieval invention, invented by that guy Chrétien de Troyes, by the way, in these Percival stories. In ancient Rome, they were not on pedestals. They were on the back. Okay? Dante's got them, you know, he wrote love poetry, okay? Where they idolize the women. So it's really the women who save him. Now, Beatrice is the special woman for him, right? Because he has another story he wrote called His New Life. And he says, when I was 9 years old, I met a girl who was 8, and she looked at me, and she saluted me, and she made me happy. She gave me beatitude, and I called her Beatrice. And he was wildly in love with her. But he never saw her again for 27 years. And then she died. Okay. So he was devoted to her idea of Beatrice or Beatitude, but he lost her. And that's the story of his new life. And here she's coming to save him. See, she's dead, but her ghost is coming down. Right? What does that mean? Well, it's pure Dante, but it means that, you know, there's some kind of salvational force that she represents to for him, right? Because I showed the movie, I didn't get to the whole thing. Let's skip to the end of 5 here. Canto 5 is the first set of sinners we see, but it's the weakest sin. And for Dante, the least culpable sin, the one he's most likely to forgive, is lust. So these are the lusty people. All right, they're way up at the top of hell. Further down you go, the worse you are. And in this, we get two things I want to point out. Line 27, and this is what you want to think about for Thursday. Pick a canto and think about this thing called how are the people being punished? In Italian, there's this thing called the contrapasso. Dante has to invent a punishment appropriate to the sin. Okay? Some people get, you know, hot rain on them. Here, the lovers are blown around by the wind, and they tumble. And that seems to be somehow appropriate to people who are always lusting and lecherous and pursuing people, light and vain, you know, no solid grounding, all right? So that's a contrapasso, and you can see them in the winds here. And we get lists of famous lovers. But at the end of the canto, we get two famous ones. They're named Paolo and Francesca. Dante says, oh, those two people there, I think I know them. Get them over here. And it's this woman comes forward, and her name is Francesca. And she says, yeah, I'm in hell, you know, because I screwed my husband's brother here, Paolo. I really like the guy, okay? And she tells her story. And, of course, it's so convincing. She says, you know, we did it for love. line 98.
Because love is good.
Love quick to kindle in the gentle heart.
If you're noble, noble people feel love, not peasants. The gentle heart, that means noble.
And then she says at the top of the next page, love that excuses no one loved from loving.
I love you, therefore you are required by the rules of love to love me back.
Oh, am I?
Yes. I took a course on it. Okay.
And then the third time love is mentioned is 107. Love led us straight to sudden death together. Love, love, love.
That's called anaphora. When you repeat a word like that.
Mandelbaum calls this the Saturday afternoon matinee dimension of Dante. Some people say it's so romantic. Love to this and love to that. But it's really more like a woman slightly whining. Love made us do it. Love, love, love. It's a little Saturday night. Anyway, you can have your own reading of it. And then she describes the moment when they fell, when she and Paolo first had their affair. They were reading the story of Lancelot. That moment, and it's like 10 volumes into this huge story, when he finally kissed the queen. And they're sitting together reading it, and they finally get to it. They kiss her, and they look at each other. You know, who cares if you're my brother's brother, my husband's brother? And that's when they fall. They do it reading the book. So the book was in the story of Lancelot, there's this guy named Galahote who pushes the queen and Lancelot together.
Oh, queen, sit here. Lancelot, you sit here.
I'm going to turn my back now. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. You know? Right? And that's what the book was, the Galahote. Right? That's what it was. So enjoy Dante. Pick a canto. Pick a sin. Revel in it. Or go to purgatory. Pick some absolution.